Are you done with that one, sir? He looked up at Betteridge, then down at the file, seeing Radley's blood spread in a tacky pool. We're in Horseferry Road, sir. The cab came to a halt. Yes, thank you. He closed the file and handed it to Betteridge. He descended from the cab and mounted the broad stairs. Regardless of the circumstances surrounding a given visit, he invariably felt a peculiar quickening upon entering the Central Statistics Bureau. He felt it now, certainly. A sense of being observed, somehow. Of being known and numbered. The eye. Yes. As he spoke to the uniformed clerk at the visitor's desk, a gang of journeymen mechanics emerged from a hallway to his left. They wore engine-cut woolen jackets and polished brogues soled with crepe rubber. Each man carried a spotless tool satchel of thick white duck, cornered with bronze rivets and brown hide. As they moved toward him, conversing among themselves, some drew pipes and cheroots from their pockets in anticipation of a shift's end smoke. Oliphant experienced a sharp pang of tobacco hunger. He had often had call to regret the Bureau's necessary policy regarding tobacco. He looked after the mechanics as they passed, out between the columns and the bronze sphinxes. Married men, assured of a Bureau pension, they would live in Camden Town, in New Cross, in any respectable suburb, and would furnish their tiny sitting rooms with papier-mâché sideboards and ornate Dutch clocks. Their wives would serve tea on gaudily japanned tin trays. Passing an irritatingly banal, quasi-biblical bas-relief, he made his way to the lift. As the attendant bowed him in, he was joined by a glum gentleman who was daubing with a handkerchief at a pale streak on the shoulder of his coat. The articulated bars of the brass cage rattled shut. The lift ascended. The gentleman with a soiled coat made his exit at the third stop. Oliphant rode on to the fifth, the home of quantitative criminology and non-linear analysis. While he found the latter infinitely more compelling than the former, it was QC he needed today, most particularly in the person of Andrew Wakefield, the departmental undersecretary. The clerks of QC were individually walled into neatly cramped cells of rolled steel, asbestos, and veneer. Wakefield presided over them from a grander version of the same scheme, his sparse, sandy head framed by the brass-fitted drawers of a multitude of card files. He glanced up as Oliphant approached, prominent front teeth displayed against his lower lip. "Mr. Oliphant, sir," he said, "a pleasure as ever. Pardon me." He shuffled a number of punch cards into a sturdy blue envelope lined with tissue paper and meticulously wound the little scarlet string about the two halves of the patent clasp. He set the envelope aside in an asbestos-lined hutch containing several other envelopes of identical hue. Oliphant smiled. "Fancy I can read your punch holes, Andrew?" He levered a spring-loaded stenographer's chair up from its ingenious housing and took a seat, his furled umbrella balanced across his knees. "Know what a blue envelope's about, do you?" Springs clanged as Wakefield folded his articulated writing desk into its narrow slot. "Not a specific one, no, but I rather imagine that's the trick of it. There are men who can read cards, Oliphant, or even a junior clerk can read the directive primaries as easily as you read the keynotes in the underground." "I never read the keynotes in the underground, Andrew." Wakefield snorted. Oliphant knew this to be his equivalent of laughter. "And how are things among the corps diplomatique, Mr. Oliphant? Coping with our Luddite conspiracy, are we?" It would have been impossible to mistake the man's sarcasm, but Oliphant pretended to take him quite literally. "It really hasn't had too great an effect as yet. Not among my own areas of special interest." Wakefield nodded, assuming that Oliphant's areas of special interest were limited to the activities of foreign nationals on British soil. On Oliphant's request, Wakefield regularly ordered the files spun on groups as diverse as the Carbonari, the Knights of the White Camellia, the Fenian Society, the Texas Rangers, the Greek Hetairai, the Pinkerton Detective Agency, and the Confederate Bureau of Scientific Research, all of whom were known to be operative in Britain. "I trust that the Texian material we provided has been of some use," Wakefield inquired, coil springs creaking behind him as he leaned forward. "Quite," Oliphant assured him. "You wouldn't know," Wakefield began, taking a gold-plated propelling pencil from his pocket, "if their legation intends a change of premises." He tapped the pencil against his front teeth, producing a loud clicking sound that Oliphant found repulsive. "From their present location in St. James's, round from Berry's, the wine merchant?"
"Precisely."
Oliphant hesitated, seeming to weigh the matter.
"I shouldn't think so. They haven't any money. I suppose it would depend upon the goodwill of the landlord, finally."
Wakefield smiled, his teeth dimpling his lower lip.
"Wakefield," Oliphant said, "do tell me. Who wishes to know?"
"Criminal anthropometry."
"Really? Are they involved in surveillance activities?"
"I gather it's technical, actually. Experimental."
Wakefield put his pencil away.
"Your savant chap, Mallory, was it?"
"Yes."
"Saw a review of his book. Off to China, is he?"
"Mongolia, heading up an expedition for the Geographical Society."
Wakefield pursed his lips and nodded.
"Out from underfoot, I should think.
Out of harm's way, one should hope. Not a bad sort, really. Seemed to keenly appreciate the technical aspects of your bureau's work. But I've a technical matter for you myself, Andrew."
"Really?"
Wakefield's springs creaked.
"Having to do with post office procedure."
Wakefield made a small, entirely non-committal sound in his throat. Oliphant took an envelope from his pocket and passed it to the undersecretary. It was unsealed. Wakefield took a pair of white cotton gloves from a wire basket at his elbow, drew them on, extracted a white telegraphic address card from the envelope, glanced at it, then met Oliphant's gaze.
"Grand's Hotel," Wakefield said.
"Quite." The establishment's crest was printed on the card. Oliphant watched as Wakefield automatically ran a gloved fingertip across the lines of punch holes, checking for indications of wear that might cause mechanical difficulties.
"You wish to know who sent it?" "That information is in my possession, thank you. Name of addressee? I am aware of that as well."
The springs creaked. Nervously, it seemed to Oliphant. Wakefield rose, with a twanging of steel, and carefully inserted the card in a brass slot, set into the face of a glass-fronted instrument which overhung a bank of card files. With a glance at Oliphant, he reached up a gloved hand and cranked down an ebony-handled lever. On the downstroke, the device thumped like a shopman's credit press. As Wakefield released the lever, it began to slowly right itself, humming and clicking like a publican's wagering machine. Wakefield watched as the whirling character wheels ticked and slowed. Abruptly, the device was silent.
"Egremont," Wakefield read aloud, but quietly. "The Beaches, Belgravia."
"Indeed,"
Oliphant watched as Wakefield extracted the card from the brass slot.
"I require the text of that telegram, Andrew."
"Egremont,"
Wakefield said, as though he hadn't heard. He took his seat again, replaced the card in its envelope, and removed his gloves.
"He seems to be everywhere, our right honourable Charles Egremont. No end of work he's making for us here, Oliphant."
"The text of the message, Andrew, is here in the bureau. It exists physically, I believe, as however many inches of telegrapher's tape. Do you know, I've 55 miles gear yardage under me, still fouled from the stink, aside from the fact that your request is rather more than usually irregular."
"Usually irregular, that's rather good.
And your friends from the special branch trooping in hourly, demanding that our brass be spun, and spun again, in hope of shaking loose these Luddites alleged to be lodged in the nation's rafters. Who is this bloody man, Oliphant?"
"A rather junior rad politician, I understand. Or was, till the stink and the resulting disorders?
Till Byron's death, rather.
But we've Lord Brunel now, haven't we?"
"Indeed. And bloody madness under him in Parliament."
Oliphant let the silence lengthen.
"If you could obtain the text of the telegram, Andrew," he said at last, very quietly, "I should be very grateful."
"He's a very ambitious man, Oliphant, with ambitious friends.
You are not alone in that assessment."
Wakefield sighed.
"Under the circumstances, extreme discretion, by all means. Aside from which, our yardage is filthy. Condensed particulate matter. We're working the mechanics on triple shifts, and having some success with Lord Colgate's aerosol applications, but I sometimes despair of ever having the system properly up and spinning."
He lowered his voice.
"Do you know that the finer functions of the Napoleon have been unreliable for months?"
"The Emperor?"
Oliphant pretended to misunderstand.
"The Napoleon's gear yardage, in equivalent terms, is very nearly double ours,"
Wakefield said,
"and it simply isn't functioning."
The thought seemed to fill him with a special horror.
had a stink of their own, have they?"
Wakefield grimly shook his head.
"There you are, then," said Oliphant. "Most likely the gears are jammed on a bit of onion skin."
Wakefield snorted.
"Do find me that telegram. At your earliest convenience, of course."
Wakefield inclined his head, but only very slightly.
"Good fellow," Oliphant declared.
He saluted the Under-Secretary with his furled umbrella and rose to retrace his steps through QC's cubbies and the bowed and patient heads of Wakefield's clerks. Oliphant had made his professionally circuitous way to Dean Street from the Soho Tavern where he had instructed Betteridge to deposit him. Now he entered a soot-streaked house, its door unlatched. Latching it carefully behind him, he climbed two flights of uncarpeted stairs. The chill air smelled of cooked cabbage and stale tobacco. He rapped twice at a door, then twice again.
"Come in, come in! You'll let in the cold!"
The heavily bearded Mr. Hermann Krieger, late of the New York Volkstribune, appeared to be wearing every article of clothing he possessed, as though he had wagered that he could all at once don the entire contents of a ragman's barrow. He locked and chained the door behind Oliphant. Krieger had two rooms, the one with the view of the street being the drawing-room, and behind it a bedroom. Everything broken and tattered, and in the greatest disorder. A large, old-fashioned table covered with wax cloth stood in the middle of the drawing-room. On it lay manuscripts, books, newspapers, a doll with a Dresden head, bits and pieces of a woman's sewing-things, chipped teacups, dirty spoons, pens, knives, candlesticks, an ink-pot, Dutch clay pipes, tobacco ash.
"Sit, sit, please!"
More ursine than ever in his bundled attire, Krieger waved vaguely toward a chair with only three legs. Blinking through a haze of coal and tobacco smoke, Oliphant made out a chair that seemed whole, though Krieger's daughter had been playing kitchen on it. Choosing to risk a pair of trousers, Oliphant swept jammy crumbs aside and sat, facing Krieger across the sad domestic litter of the crowded tabletop.
"A small gift for your little toddle," Oliphant said, taking a tissue-wrapped parcel from his coat.
The tissue was secured with a self-adhesive rectangle, embossed with the initials of an Oxford Street toy emporium.
"A doll's tea things."
He placed the parcel on the table.
"She calls you Uncle Larry. She shouldn't know your name."
"Many's the Larry about Soho, I should imagine." Oliphant produced a plain envelope, unsealed, and placed it beside the parcel, precisely aligned with the table's edge. It contained three well-circulated £5 notes. Krieger said nothing. A silence lengthened.
"The Manhattan Women's Red Pantomime Troupe," Oliphant said at last.
Krieger snorted derisively.
"The Bowery's Sapphic Best come to London. I remember them in Purdy's National. They wooed and won the dead rabbits to the cause, whose sole previous involvement with politics had consisted of rock fights and punch-ups in municipal elections. The butcher boys, the boot blacks, the prostitutes of Chatham Square and the Five Points, that was their audience. Sweaty proletarians come to see a woman shot out of a gun, flattened against a wall and peeled off like paper. I tell you, sir, your interest is misplaced."
Oliphant sighed.
"My friend, it is my job to ask questions. You must understand that I cannot tell you my reasons for asking a given question. I know that you have suffered. I know that you suffer now in exile."
Oliphant glanced meaningfully about the tragic room.
"What then do you wish to know?"
"It has been suggested that among the various criminal elements active during the recent civil disruptions were agents of Manhattan."
Oliphant waited.
"I find that unlikely."
"On what basis, Mr. Krieger?"
"To my knowledge, the Commune has no interest in disturbing the British status quo. Your rads have shown themselves to be benevolent bystanders with regard to America's class struggle. Indeed, your nation has behaved as an ally of sorts."
There was much bitterness in Krieger's tone, a curdled cynicism.
"One imagines it was in Britain's own interest to see the Northern Union lose its greatest city to the Communards."
Oliphant shifted cautiously on the uncomfortable chair.
"You knew Mr. Marx intimately, I believe."
In order to extract a given piece of information from Krieger, he knew, it was necessary to engage the man's dominant passion.
"Knew him? I was there to greet him off the boat. He embraced me, and not a minute later had borrowed 20 gold dollars to pay his rent in the Bronx. Krieger essayed a sort of laugh, strangled with abiding rage. He'd his Jenny with him then, though the marriage didn't survive the revolution. But he'd a Brooklyn Irish factory girl in his bed when he expelled me from the commune, sir, for preaching religionism and free love. Free love, indeed. Krieger's large, pale hands, with their unkept nails, plucked abstractedly at a sheaf of papers.
You have been badly used, Mr. Krieger,
Oliphant thought of his friend, Lord Engels.
It did seem extraordinary that the brilliant textile manufacturer should involve himself, however distantly, with people of this sort.
Krieger had been a member of the Commune's so-called Central Committee before Marx had sent him packing. With a price on his head in the Northern Union, he had sailed in steerage from Boston, penniless, under an assumed name, with his wife and child, to join London's thousands of American refugees.
"These Bowery pantomimes."
"Yes?"
Oliphant leaned forward.
"There are factions within the party."
"Do go on."
"Anarchists disguising themselves as communists, feminists, all manner of incorrect ideologies, you see. Covert cells not under Manhattan's control."
"I see," Oliphant said,
thinking of the reams of yellow fanfold representing the confession of William Collins. Again on foot, Oliphant made his roundabout way through Soho to Compton Street, where he paused before the entrance of a public house known as the Blue Boar.
"A sporting gentleman," he was informed by a large bill, "a staunch supporter of the destruction of these vermin, would give a gold repeater watch to be killed for by dogs under 13¾ pounds weight."
Below the smudged bill, a painted wooden placard advertised, "Rats always on hand for the accommodation of gentlemen to try their dogs." He entered, and shortly was greeting Fraser in the rank smell of dogs, tobacco smoke, and hot penny gin. The long bar was crowded with men of every grade of society, many with their animals under their arms. There were bulldogs, Skye terriers, small brown English terriers. The room was low-ceilinged and quite unadorned. About the wall were hung clusters of leather collars.
"You came by cab, sir?" Fraser inquired.
"On foot from a previous appointment."
"Here now!" cried the barman. "Don't block up the bar!"
There was a general movement toward the parlour, where a young waiter now shouted, "Give your orders, gentlemen!" With Fraser at his side, Oliphant followed the crowd of sporting men and their dogs. Above the parlour fireplace were glass-fronted cases displaying the stuffed heads of animals famous in their day. Oliphant noticed the head of a bull terrier, its glass eyes bulging hugely.
"Looks as though this one died of strangulation," Oliphant remarked, pointing the thing out to Fraser.
"They've spoilt her in the stuffing, sir," said the waiter, a fair-haired boy in a greasy striped apron. "Good as any in England, she was. I've seen her kill 20 at a go, though they killed her at the last. Your sewer rats are dreadful for giving a dog canker, though we'd always rinse her mouth out well with peppermint and water."
"Your sayers, boy," Fraser said. "We want a word with him."
"Why, I know you, sir. You were here about that Saventry gent."
"Your old dad, Jem, and brisk about it," Fraser interjected,
preventing the boy from announcing the arrival of a copper to the assembled sportsman.
"He's upstairs lighting the pit, sir," the boy said.
"Good chap," Oliphant said, giving the boy a shilling.
Oliphant and Fraser mounted a broad wooden staircase which led to what had once been the drawing-room. Opening a door, Fraser led the way into the rat-killing apartment.
"Pit's not bloody open," bellowed a fat man with ginger side whiskers.
Oliphant saw that the pit consisted of a wooden circus some 6 feet in diameter, fitted with a high rim at elbow height. Above it branched the arms of an 8-mantle gaslight, brightly illuminating the white painted floor of the little arena. Mr. Sayers, the Blue Boar's proprietor, in a bulging silk waistcoat, stood with a live rat in his left hand.
"But it's you, Mr. Fraser. My apologies, sir."
Having caught the creature somehow by the throat, he deftly prized out its larger teeth with no more implement than his strong thumbnail.
"Order for a dozen with her teeth drawed."
He dropped the mutilated rat into a rusted wire cage with several others and turned to face his visitors.
"How might we be of service, Mr. Fraser?"
Fraser took out an engine-stippled morgue portrait.
"Aye, he's your man," Sayers said, his brows rising. "Big chap, long in the leg. And a dead'un by the look of it."
"You're quite positive," Oliphant could smell the rats now.
"'This is Professor Radwick's murderer?'
"'Aye, sir. "'We gets all sorts here, but none too many Argentine giants. "'I recall him quite plain.'
Fraser had taken out his notebook and was writing in it. "'Argentine?' Oliphant asked.
"'He spoke Spanish,' Sayers said. "'Also I took it to be. "'Now, mind you, we none of us saw him do the deed, "'but he was on the premises that night, so he was.'
"'Cabin's here?'
Sayers' son called from the doorway.
"'Hell, and I've not drawed the teeth of half his rats.'
"'Fraser,' Oliphant said, "'I fancy a warm gin. "'Let us retire to the bar and allow Mr. Sayers to complete arrangements for the evening's sport.' He bent to examine a larger cage, this one of iron bands. It seemed to contain a solid mound of rats.
"'Mind your fingers there,' Sayers said. "'But believe me, you get a bite and you'll not forget it. These here are none of the cleanest.'
In the parlour, a young officer, evidently the captain, was threatening to leave the place if he were kept waiting any longer.
"'I shouldn't drink that if I were you,' Fraser said, looking at Oliphant's noggin of warm gin. "'Almost certainly adulterated.'
"'Actually, it's quite good,' Oliphant said. "'It has a very faint aftertaste, rather like bitter wormwood.
"'An intoxicant poison.'
"'Quite. The French use it in the preparation of herbals. "'What do you make of our good captain here?'
Oliphant gestured with his gin, "'indicating the man in question, who was pacing about in an agitated fashion, "'examining the paws of various animals as their owners presented them, "'all the while shouting that he should depart immediately if the pit weren't opened.'
"'Crimea,' Fraser said.
The captain bent to peer at the claws of a young terrier in the arms of a swarthy, rather portly man whose pomaded spit curls protruded like wings from beneath his high-crowned derby.
"'Velasco,'
Fraser said, as if to himself, something nastily akin to pleasure in his tone, and was instantly beside the fellow. The captain started, his handsome young face convulsed with a violent tick, and Oliphant's eye abruptly filled with all the red Crimea, whole cities aflame like bonfires, and shell-churned wastes of jellied filth sprouting white flowers that were men's hands. He shuddered with the intensity of the vision, then forgot it utterly.
"'Do I know you, sir?'
the captain inquired of Fraser, with a brittle, murderous jollity.
"'Gentlemen!'
Mr. Sayers cried from the stairs. Led by the captain, the entire company, save only Oliphant, Fraser, the swarthy man, and a fourth man, made for the pit above. The fourth man, perched on the arm of a ragged brocade armchair, began to cough. Oliphant saw Fraser's grip tighten about his prey's upper arm.